It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 578 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week, Claire Napier is my special guest, and she's discussing her book, The Magic Necklace, which is available on Zoop.gg. It's described this way. Ann Reed is acting differently since she came back because she's not afraid of men anymore. Not her brother, not the fuzz, and not the guy standing right beside her. Whatever he does, it just can't threaten her. It's a new one-shot comic that is adult-only, and it talks about sexual danger, desire, relying on men, and the bargains we make with ourselves and others. We discuss how the book came to be, the way comics today are helping to discuss gender roles, and what we can expect from her in the future, so I'm sure you're going to enjoy what she has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show! It's great to welcome to the podcast Claire Napier, the creator of a fascinating book called The Magic Necklace that's available on Zoop.gg as we're speaking, and it's probably going to conclude roughly about 30 days after St. Valentine's Day. So how's it going, Claire?
Hi, it's going pretty well, thank you.
I always appreciate getting to talk to a female creator, because I can talk to guys all the time, and comics tend to be a guy's thing. So, but
well, I get there to talk are plenty to a woman, of us out there. Perhaps you'll get more after this.
I'm hoping, because I've had several. I mean, I've gotten to talk to Gail Simone and some others and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I always treasure when I get to talk to a lady creator. So it's always special for me.
Well, so, I'll try to live up to that.
Oh, I'm sure you will. That'll be fun to do. Now, first thing I want to say right out of the gate is that this is not necessarily a book for children.
It's certainly not, no.
And so I just want to make sure people know that. Doesn't mean it's a bad book. It just means that I would not let your kid wander in and pick this book up if you have other books around. This might be one you want to keep for your private collection. Those kinds of things go. So, let me read real quickly what it says on Zoop.gg. And by the way, it's Zoop.gg/SeasonCat/The Magic Necklace, all one word. And that'll take you right to where the campaign is going. Let me read what it says on here about it, because there's some interesting stuff in there that we want to talk about. It says it's a horror comic about getting what you deserve. And right away, I'm in trouble, I'm sure. With that, getting what you deserve. And this is Ann Reed is acting differently since she bought Morgan Le Fay's necklace. She's not afraid of men anymore. Not her brother, not the fuzz, and not the guy who's standing right beside her. Whatever he does, it just can't threaten her. If you've ever wanted a comic about why women let bad boys and bad men in, this is that one. What's fair in love and war isn't always black and white. But add some pink, and you're more than halfway there. Help us take this story all the way. So it's interesting stuff about – talk a little bit about more about getting what you deserve.
Well, it's tricky, isn't it? Because depending on the person or the part of the person's life that we're looking at any given moment, that could be extremely variable. It could be a positive. It could be neutral. It could be perhaps more of a negative. And I wouldn't like to give – too much of a concrete impression of which of those things we see for each of the characters, because then no one will want to read the story. There's a little bit of everything, I think. All the shades of the pink are on the plate.
Okay. I'm going to tell a story from my own background. There was a guy I knew who was always terrified that he would get what he deserved. there was a guy I knew who used to love to gossip. He worked in an accounting office in a college where I was going to school, and he loved nothing better than gossip. On and on and on and on he went about this. And then down the road, when we got towards the end of his life, what happened, but he lost his ability to speak.
Oh, no.
And I always used to say, I said, boy, that was, you know, his life came back to haunt him. Mm. How he can't gossip anymore. And so I had a friend of mine used to say, don't say that, don't say that. I don't want that to happen to me. He was worried about those kinds of things. And so that's the first thing when I read that, I thought the first thing that popped into my head was about that kind of thing. Was there a circumstance that inspired this story?
Not precisely, no. It's not like autobiographical. It's not based on anything specific. I enjoy that kind of poetic irony. I think it's funny. Like you said, it's pleasant to see things get balanced. Though sometimes that balance might be brutal. It provides a sort of catharsis, doesn't it? Anyone who may have resented that guy's gossip about them, I'm sure that they had maybe not fully positive feelings about his misfortune, but they may have enjoyed it to some degree. They may have felt vindicated, even though perhaps what he was gossiping about them was something that they had no right to expect privacy on. There's like a rolling give and take of consequences in life, isn't there? Both moral and more amoral. And I just think that's fun. I think it's an interesting thing to make stories out of, and it offers a lot of storytelling is kind of like maths to me, in that there are formulas involved often, and I enjoy balancing the equation of a story. If you can put in enough possibility and inference and event in the first half or third of a story, then getting to balance that with poetic irony in the back half it's fun. It's a good challenge. It's like dancing with a partner, you know, but the partner is yourself.
Because I always used to think that the best writers or it was like getting into a car with somebody. You're going someplace, and you know the driver knows where that person's going.
Yes.
But the other person may not, but still you get there. The worst stories to me are the ones where you kind of get in the car and you just meander around and nobody knows where we're going, and you never get anywhere. You know, and some people think that's wonderful storytelling, but not to me. I like something that actually goes someplace. And you could tell in the writing that from the start, the writer, the creator knows where they're going based on what's happening. And I think your book does that really well.
Thank you. That's wonderful to hear. I'm really glad. Thank you.
Now you do the whole thing, the whole package here.
Yes.
You do the writing, the lettering, coloring apparently. This is your book.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. Now, tell me, you were saying before we started recording that you have some experience, too, in the comics industry. Why don't you talk about what you've done before The Magic Necklace?
Sure. Well, I was a critic for 10 years, both writing criticism and editing criticism on Women Write About Comics, as well as a few other places. That was like my main point of work. And I still do produce comics writing, comics criticism occasionally on my Patreon and occasionally elsewhere. This year I've been doing a couple of introductions for the Treasury of British Comics new volumes that they'll be putting out later in the year or next year. But 5 years ago now, actually, I moved into editing. So I've worked on a lot of projects in those 5 years. I don't know how it would compare to the workload of an editor working at a publisher, because I'm freelance. I work for creators. So I have no way of comparing the two professional lifestyles, really. But it's felt like a lot. It's felt like many, many books have come through my hands. Some of them have still yet to be published, because making comics is hard. It takes a long time. But the ones that have come out very proud of all of them. I really enjoy editing because it allows that same kind of problem solving that I mentioned with the balancing the equation. But I don't have to do all the rest. I can just help with sort of the mechanical elements and ensure that teams are running smoothly. And I like it. It's nice to have my terminal, these different pies. I find it very pleasant to look at the different pieces of process that the industry offers and dip in and out as and when I'm specifically needed and requested. It keeps it interesting. Nothing ever gets boring when you're doing a lot of things at once.
Mm-hmm. See, I'm an editor as well. I edit an indie comic that's called Stabbity Bunny. And the writer would do for me was he would give me the script a page at a time.
Gosh.
And what he wanted was he wanted my reaction.
Yeah.
How did that page react? What did you think about this? And what did you think about that? And so I was able to give him a lot of immediate feedback. Mm-hmm. Regarding those kinds of things, which, you know, I thought went really well. It's what he needed for his story to go well. And that was one time when he wrote a page that he wanted to be very funny. And he gave me the page and I said, it's not funny enough. You know, you want something to make people laugh at the end. And it's just, I smiled, but you said you wanted it to be really funny. Mm-hmm. So he went back and he reworked it and he came up with something much better. And that's kind of what I always like to say, that editors are like Batman. We prefer the shadows. We don't want, I've seen editors who want their names above the writers and above the artists and stuff. And I'm going, no, that's not where editors belong. Our job is to make other people look good.
Yeah.
That's what we're here for.
To make sure the work is the best it can be, the best version of itself that it can be. Not make it into something else, but to make it into your thing, but polished.
See, that's something I always compare this to like John Byrne. When John Byrne would ink somebody, they always looked like John Byrne had drawn it because he smothered the original artist with his own style. And I always tell editors, don't do that. You know, it's not your story. This is their story. Make it the best that it can be for what they're doing. So that's what I do. I don't know. What's your take on all that?
I would agree with you for sure. John Byrne, I think, is known to have very specific opinions. And I can't say that I'm different. I certainly have my own ideas about many things. But I guess one of them is that other people's stories are fun. I enjoy being told stories and experiencing someone else's perspective. So I want to do that. I don't want to just experience my perspective over and over and over, because I do all the time. Like, you can't turn that off. I've always been a very motivated fictioneer, I suppose. I was a constant reader as a child. I was always being told I'd watched enough television. People have always told me that I don't need to own that many movies. I don't need to watch another film. But I like it. I like getting other people's stories into me and seeing what I think of them and seeing if they make any difference to me. So why would I change? Why would I like put that away if I have the opportunity to make sure that other people's stories are really vibrant and really lasting and really impactful? That's much more rewarding than turning them into my own thing. Much, much more.
Mm-hmm. Now, the thing that you have made the jump that I have never been able to make, and I'm so a little envious of that. I can write reviews, and I often do, about comics, and I can tell you what makes a great story or what makes a story great that I'm reviewing or something like that. But to make that leap from I can tell you that's good to writing a good story is the leap I haven't been able to make, but you've been able to make that jump. Talk about how did you do that? What did you suddenly say, boy, I wish I could write a story. If I wrote a story, I would do X and X. Did that happen to you?
No, actually it didn't. I mean, when I was young, when I was a child, I liked the idea of having written a story, and sometimes I would try, but I didn't really understand the process, the doing part. And I didn't really, I would always just regurgitate, essentially. I would just rewrite, like, I remember a story that I wrote. I don't remember anything else about it, but I remember that my mum was impressed that I had said something about the two moons. And I remember that because it made me feel ashamed, because I knew that I had just taken that from Star Wars, because I'd just seen Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And she didn't know that, because my mum's not a big film person. Mm-hmm. So that, like, ugly feeling of recognizing that I hadn't done anything except use someone else's idea, I never felt like I was just about to be a writer, or like I was just about to write fiction. Like, it never seemed truthful, I suppose. I never felt like I knew how to do it. I did, like, when I was a little bit older than that, I would always joke that one day I would write a romance novel, because I read a lot of them, because you can read them very fast and they're very cheap. And they're like, it's anyone, I mean, everybody knows, air quotes, that romance novels are formulaic. So my parents would joke about that, and why, like, ask, you know, why do you enjoy reading them? They're just all to a formula. And they are, like, that's true. But like I said, stories are like maths to me. So that's not a bad thing. If you have a formula, you can do a lot of stuff. Like, just ask the physicists, the chemists as well. So I would joke that one day I would write one, because I just know, I knew how they worked. Like, I could, you know, bolt one together. But I never did, because, again, that's not real. It's just, it's false. It's just regurgitation. It's just pastiche. It's rude, essentially. It felt rude to me. Like, I didn't want to just write a joke just, like, out of spite, almost. But I think that that kind of thinking was useful, because I was looking at the structural nature of those things, and how they worked, and how they could work, and how the formulas, what, like, the fact that they existed, and what they looked like. I was getting used to them, and getting used to the idea of thinking around that kind of thing. I wrote fan fiction a couple of times as a teenager, but it always petered out, because it wasn't, I just wanted to join in. It wasn't really creative output. It was just trying to be someone who did that. And then in my 20s, my partner and I were always making up ideas for video games, for fighting games. We'd make up arrays of characters and things like that. And that was very, very useful creative work, because in fighting games, there's very sparse storytelling. You get characters, and they have to be characterful enough that people want to play as them and find out what's happening, because there'll always be a story mode where you can play through an essential story. And by winning, you get to the end of the story. And often that's the story of the game, because, you know, fighting games, you get sequel and sequel and sequel, and each one has to have a bit of new story. So they do have story in, it's just the story's not absolutely, like, narrative delivery is not absolutely prioritized. What's absolutely prioritized is fights between all the different characters. But that means that there has to be at least a bit of story between most of them, so that the scenes where story's happening aren't boring and people think, I will just play the no story mode. So we would do a lot of character development and character design, and that was really fun. And that is also extremely narrative. And it sometimes having that, like, limited scope, like, just think of a cool character, is really useful, because you're thinking about story specifically in those terms, in terms of this person. Like, if you're trying to think of a backstory, it doesn't matter, like, what the politics of the country that they live in are, unless it specifically relates to them as a person. So you sort of learn almost automatically how to boil down that kind of information, and how to evoke just enough of it that it means something to a person, rather than the person being there just to deliver a bunch of info. But we never really developed that into, like, product or anything. It was just something that we enjoyed or something that we did. So I was kind of teaching myself in a few lanes at once, I guess. And then a few years ago, it just started to work. The machinery in the back of my mind just started putting things together in the right kind of way, and stories just seemed to go all of a sudden.
Wow. Good for you.
Thank you.
See, I haven't reached that level. If I write something, it's very blah. I can't think of the good surprises. And the things that make me want to read comics in particular, I just can't think of it. You know, it's just not in there yet. So
maybe you're just coming at it from kind of the wrong perspective. I mean, if you're trying to think of something surprising, that's almost never going to happen, because you have to have like coincidence to surprise you. But if you think of, I mean, the way that I do it now is I think of a premise. Like last week, I thought of, I kind of was thinking, what if I did a mummy story? And then I thought, well, but I don't want to do a mummy story, because Britain has done enough to ancient and current Egypt. We don't need to bother them anymore. So then I thought, what kind of mummy could I use, though? Because there are other kinds of mummies. And then I thought, well, we have a lot of burials, like a Viking or an Anglo-Saxon, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so then I have an essential premise. And then I think about what kind of character I want to, who do I want my heroine to be, essentially? Like, what kind of person do I want to spend time writing? What kind of things do I want to spend time getting out of me? And then I just think about how those two things can cross-reference with each other, and what kinds of details would probably be in there, and what kinds of so on and so on. And then when you're creating out of practical necessity, almost, like, you know, the essential bedrock of the aesthetic and the thematics, it's much easier, because you're not like shooting for a hoop that's really far away, that's like made of gold, which is the idea of like a good story. Mm-hmm. You're not trying to make a good story. You're just trying to make what you've got here work. It's like like making a sculpture out of scrap iron. You've just got to look at what you've given you, like the resources that you want to work with, and see if any of them start fitting together. I think that's what works for me. It may not work for you, but maybe it will. And I think if you want to, it would be a shame not to try and help.
Okay, well, I'll give it a try is what I'll do. I'll approach it from that angle. Which, of course, this is just perfect to get into talking about the characters in the story. you've got Ann Rita. And who is Ann Rita, the main character?
I don't want to say too much about who she is widely, because some of that comes out, and I kind of want it to be a surprise. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
As we meet her, she is a kind of a daffy, nice girl, with no walls socially, no self-protective stance. She's just wandering around in her little dress, in her high heels, with no purse, having a nice time, trying to have a nice time, trying to order fancy food and have a drink before it's really that time of day, and just make friends and let people approach her and be welcoming and open and mild, essentially. She's a good girl, but she's not someone who, I guess, in patriarchal terms, not someone who should be allowed to roam around on her own, because she doesn't have her eye out for herself.
Huh, that's interesting. Of course, then she runs into that, as it says in the description, the man who's standing right behind her.
Yeah,
and he's about the other end of the spectrum. Why don't you talk about who he is?
He is. Well, I mean, He's a bad boy. He's pretty much the kind of guy who you shouldn't talk to. I know that that's the kind of person that I shouldn't talk to. You can't trust him. He's not nice. He's a liar. But he's so interesting. Like, he's got a little Game Boy in his pocket, and he's got a big fur coat, and he lounges around, and he's in charge of things, and he does nice things for her. So he's enticing. There's no reason why you necessarily would want to tell him to go away or to ignore him, but he's not safe.
And yet she does, even though he's not safe, she does. I guess that's the good thing about fiction. You can actually do these kinds of things, quote unquote, safely.
Well, she's got the magic necklace, so she's fine. It's magic. You don't need to be careful if you've got magic.
So things develop, shall we say, and we get to go on a kind of a little journey with the two of them. And as I said, this is for adults, and we get a lot of adult work, shall we say. Things happen in an adult arena. And I'm kind of curious as to, because you're doing not only the writing, but the art.
Mm.
How did you decide you wanted to portray the more adult sequences in there? Was there inspiration that you were drawing from? Was it just something that you happened to like and it came out as you were drawing it? How did you decide to do that?
I wanted to be as factual as possible, which I don't mean in like a literal sense. But people have sex. We do it. People do it. And they do various things. And I feel like pretending otherwise always is not healthy. And in comics, often always is always. There are a lot of comic books which certainly do include children as their audience. So not putting in anything explicit is very reasonable. But they're inexplicit in ways that I find disingenuous often. Like, you will very often get as much breast detail in a Big Two comic as I have in this comic. It's just that in this comic, they're not covered, like textually, and someone's touching them in a way that the owner enjoys. I approached it in a way that felt like it was saying, I'm a critical creator. I didn't become a critic on a whim, you know? I have that kind of response to media. I don't think that the way that women's bodies and sexuality and men's bodies and everyone else's bodies and sexuality, I don't think that the majority of the material is honest or fair or reasonable. You know, like, it's not a secret that comic books are sexist and often sexualize, especially the women. And like, having read them for a lifetime, it feels like drawing the book as I've drawn it feels like just saying, I wish you would be honest. I wish you wouldn't pretend that this isn't what you're pretending you're not drawing. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Like, so many artists put in so much detail and particular angles, and they make choices that are designed to present the women as sexual morsels. And so I drew my book in a way that was designed to foreground what it feels like to not only do things like that, but to be looked at that way. Mm-hmm. And to have that kind of body. Because so much that I've seen so many drawings of boobs in my life by men.
Okay.
That drawing them myself was extremely bettering. Because when you're a young person, one of the primary ways you have to understand the world is through media.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see a lot of drawings of perfectly spherical breasts, and you don't see a lot of naked breasts, which I personally didn't,
mm-hmm.
there wasn't a wide range of people, of adults, that I was seeing naked.
Mm-hmm.
The way that we understand body possibility is through drawings as well. Like it's through everything that we see. And if all that we're seeing is largely drawn material, then that's what we think we're supposed to be. That's what we think is supposed to happen. That's what we think we're supposed to look like and perform as and be. Like, it's very overwhelming to think about in retrospect. But comic book artists have defined a lot of what I knew about women's bodies.
Mm-hmm.
They don't anymore, but they have done.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel a certain level of aesthetic responsibility to reflect what I think I needed to understand now that I have the option of doing so.
It's so interesting because isn't it also true of male bodies, though? Because, you know, superheroes are very muscular. And whenever somebody is not that way in a comic, it's usually for comedy effect. You know, like, I don't know if you remember, this is probably way before your time, but there used to be a group called the Inferior Five. And there was a guy called Merryman, and he was supposed to be the guy in charge. But he had a very thin, unmuscular kind of body. And mm-hmm. being the leader, it was just the opposite of what you expected of that character. And so it was comedic the way that it's done. And it's often the case that we look at, you know, men, if men are not like Superman or Batman or any of these people, we kind of look at them as less than what they
could. Who's drawing them, though?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. See, but that's the thing. That's the thing. I think it's so interesting to me how, and as somebody who grew up reading comics, the first thing I ever read was a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
I always how comics have influenced my perspective on the world. On many levels, including what you're talking about. It's so fascinating to me.
Mm. There was a small, it wasn't really anything actually, but when the trailer for Wakanda Forever, I think it was, came out, there was an artist who made a fuss about the Namor guy not looking muscular enough. An artist who'd drawn Namor being really muscular.
Right.
And I didn't really see any men making a fuss about this guy. Like, he was literally saying this human body, this human being, doesn't look enough like the way that I drew this hypermuscular superhero.
Hmm.
And I didn't really see any men protesting on the grounds of, like, the harm that attitude and that actual, like, enacted drawing decision mm-hmm. has done. Like, when I've seen a lot of women and men and non-binary people object to the way that that men have drawn women.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen people respond that no one complains about superheroes being muscular. Mm-hmm. But then when I think it was it Deodato? I think it was. If it wasn't, I apologize to him. I really felt like I should have seen more actual studied protest of that man saying that a human being didn't look enough like the muscular drawing that he'd drawn.
Hmm. Have you ever seen, there was a guy that went back and he drew superheroes as if they were real people?
I don't think I have.
Iron Man is obese. And other people and characters are much more, quote unquote, realistic. And so I always, when I first came across those, I was really fascinated by that because, that's kind of, if it wasn't a comic book, that's kind of the way it would go. And so I'm just fascinated by those kinds of things.
I think a great example of a third way is Barry Windsor Smith. Because everyone he draws is gorgeous, but that doesn't mean that everyone he draws is like ideologically perfect visually. Mm-hmm. Like they don't look or look like magazine people. For example, his work on Weapon X, the scientist that he draws is balding. He's got glasses, but he's still lovely. He's lovely to look at because he's drawn by Barry Windsor Smith. Mike Ulrich is another one. In fact, he reminds me of Barry Windsor Smith draws guys who look like that quite often, I think. But that specific template, I suppose, reminds me very much of a guy in an episode of Designing Women. Have you seen that show?
Mm-hmm.
So there's an episode called Dash Goff the Writer, which is about the ex-husband of one of them. Who comes back and he's a famous writer, but he's got writer's block and his last book was rejected and he's feeling very depressed. And he's just so charming. He's so charming and interesting and pays such good, genuine attention to all of the ladies in the show. There are four of them. That's his ex-wife, his ex-sister-in-law, and their two friends. He just completely wins them all over because he's so sexy. And it's not because he looks like he doesn't have a chiseled jaw and he doesn't have muscles. So it's not because he looks like that. And it's not that he's sexy despite the fact that he's balding and has glasses and is like skinny or whatever. It's just that he's a sexy person. And so the way that he looks becomes part of that sexiness. And I think that it's a massive, massive failure on the part of essentially all creatives if they don't bother to try and create that much character in their characters, if they don't try to make people who look interesting and enjoyable and are fun to spend time with and look at without making them square-jawed and wide-shouldered and massive breasted and enormous head. Like it's just lazy and it's cutting you off from your own possibilities. I don't see why it's the standard because it means nobody has any fun and it means everybody gets depressed.
It's I've often heard that said of like Barbie dolls and stuff like that women are grow up with expectations that somehow they have to look like this Barbie doll. And even the doll, you know, oftentimes doesn't look exactly like the way that the Barbie doll is supposed to. So we should be more open to what is interesting and what is appealing, seems to me. So anyway, I we could talk about this for quite a long time, I'm sure. But I do want to talk about a couple of interesting choices you made in the magic.
Okay.
Instead of drawing it four color, it looks to me like you're using only two colors in the printing process, and that's black and it looks like magenta. Mm-hmm. Is that the color you're using?
Yes.
Okay. Now, why did you make those choices? Because that's an interesting choice.
Well, I wanted the book to look like it is supposed to feel, somewhat dissociative, somewhat swoopingly romantic, somewhat, and sexy. And hot pink I mean, it's called hot pink. black and white is supposed to be, I mean, we talk about black and white, like the issues are black and white, like they're clear and easy to pass. So that's poetic irony again, because it's not supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be complicated. Mm-hmm. Combining the two, the black and white and the hot pink, it just felt expressive. It felt like this book will be easier to understand, this story will be easier to understand, and these characters will feel realer in these colors rather than if I went for total realism. Like, imagine if it was a photo comic, it would be awful. It would be just awful. I just couldn't think of anything better for this story. So this is what I went with.
Interesting, because it's an interesting choice. We don't get to see that very often in comics, to be honest with you. You're right. People either do black and white or they do full color. And mm-hmm. it's nice to see something in a mid-range that is something very different. I really like that.
I'm glad.
There's one thing, and I don't want to spoil things too much, but the way that you do the comic is kind of the reverse of the way normal comics do. What I mean by that is that we go through the story, and it's 44 pages, and the last page has something of an explanation or defining of what you've just read. Seems to me. I want to ask about that. What were you doing when you decided to create that?
I don't know. This is just how it came out. I spoke about it in terms of an equation, right? Mm-hmm. And you balance it at the end. The equals whatever. I guess that's that part. I did it the way that felt the most exciting. It felt like the funnest way to hold it up to the light. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I wanted to see if it would work.
It's really interesting because, you know, like I said, we don't usually page 44 is page one mm-hmm. in comics. So for me to see it this way was very interesting. We go through the experience and then we come to find out a little bit more about it after that. And I think it's a very creative way to tell the story compared to what we're used to in comics. And so I just wanted to point that out. Now, if you want to read the story the way that it's intended, read all the pages and then get to page 44 at the end. Because that's obviously the way Claire wants that to run.
Yes, please.
And so, but if you have any questions when you get to the end, I think that will clear up at least some of those questions the way that's done. Now, I thought that was that's a creative and unique way of approaching that. And it's something in comics we don't really get to see very much. And so I wanted to congratulate you for doing something we haven't seen before. And
I've
read comics for decades, literally. And when I got to it, I was like, that's different. And I got to be honest with you, I like different. I like variety. And so for me, I just thought that the Magic Necklace is a whole bunch of variety, which is something that we as comic readers could stand more of. So I just think it's just super well done.
How wonderful to hear. Thank you.
Okay, again, it's The Magic Necklace. It's by Claire Napier. It's on zoop.gg. Again, zoop.gg/CAT/ The Magic Necklace. It's going to end about a month after Valentine's Day, roughly that time. And do you have other things going on right now, Claire, or is this keeping you busy?
Well, I've always got other things going on. Let's see. I think Paul Allure and Juan Romero's Zoop campaign has just finished, so I can't plug that. I edited that, obviously. Miskatonic High probably has another issue on Kickstarter right now, because they almost always do. They're very consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that I edit. I think Wild Nature Volume 3 should be coming up on Kickstarter in a month or two, maybe less. Don't miss that, because this is the final volume. Everything falls apart and comes together again. I've got several projects that are still boiling. A couple of mid-grade ones, which should be pretty exciting. There's just so much. I'm on so many books, so many projects. Okay. Torch Reclaim the Skies, issue 3, might also be kickstarting soon. The third volume of Reanimator Incorporated, I think, will be crowdfunding this year. Before I get to Dallas is another one that I think that will be crowdfunding soon.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So many.
That's good. It's great when somebody is creative and they say, well, I can't talk about everything that I'm working on. I always go, well, that's good. That means there's irons in the fire that
there are.
We're going to get to see about later.
Now, absolutely. Chris,
if people want to keep up with you on social media, it looks like, according to Zoop, you've got 4 social media places we can go. How accurate is that? How do we find you?
Oh, well, I'm on Twitter all the time. Quite regularly TikTok, if that's your vibe. I have an Instagram, which I mostly only post my stories on. Instagram stories, that is, not comic stories. I do have a Tumblr, but I don't use it a lot. But it is a good place to keep up with my projects. When I say I don't use it a lot, I mean I don't really look at a lot of other people's blogs. But if you're interested in my work, that's a good place to keep up to date. And if I've forgotten anything, my website collects it all, clairenapier.com.
Okay. And of course, that's Claire, Napier, Napier.
Yes.
Because the internet is a bad place for spelling. We want to get sure that people can find you. Well, Claire, it's been an absolute joy talking with you. And when something comes up in the future, I hope we can talk again because, I think we barely scratched the surface of all this good stuff. But again, that's the Magic Necklace. Be sure not to miss out because we want to see more. If this goes well, do you think there might be a Magic Necklace 2 in our future?
I don't, but I am already working on the next. It's kind of a loose series. I mean, it's not really a series at all, but the comics that I make myself are pretty much all horror romance comics. So the last one I did was called Take Me to the Place I Love, which was about Paris and Venice and demons and dreams and a much more traditional take on romance. And the next one is called Green Snake, and it's about incel cults and virgin sacrifice. So watch out for that.
That's different. I'll have to say that. I've never read that before. Something good. If we want something different, go look for Claire, and I think you'll find something very unique and very special there. So, Claire, great talking with you. Again, it's a zoop.gg. Don't miss it because it's going to be something you're definitely going to want to add to your collection. And something you can read every once in a while as the spirit moves you. So, much success, Claire. I hope this is a big, big hit and that other people and you get to do other things that we get to talk about more in the future.
I would love to be back sometime.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.